Hi, Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. Ethics is a word with several very precise definitions and many, many more usages. Ethics is a precise field of philosophical inquiry, an academic discipline, and it is also something parents try to give a sense of to their children, although the ethical discussions of the dinner table are not the same thing as the ethical discussions of the academy. Peter Singer is acknowledged by his colleagues as one of the outstanding ethical philosophers of our time. His volume of essays, Practical Ethics, has found its way onto the required reading lists of many university philosophy courses. That fact is extraordinary when you consider the controversy that attends the book. In it, Singer argues dispassionately for why animals should not be killed simply to feed human appetites, and equally dispassionately for killing severely deformed infants in certain cases. We're joined in this hour by Peter Singer, Ira DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University. Connection listeners, how do you define ethics? How do you define ethics? Is it right to argue, however reasonably, for ever taking the life of another human? And at what point in our existence do we become moral beings? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-TALK, makes the ethical connection with Peter Singer. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Michael.
For the purpose of this discussion, what is ethics?
Ethics is the study of decision-making about how we ought to live, about what we ought to do, about the good life. All of those things, I think, come under the rubric of ethics. It used to be regarded as something a little separate from morality, I think, in some ways, but I no longer draw that distinction because I think common usage has changed and, you know, we can talk about ethics, we can talk about morality. The differences between them are too fine to really focus on.
Do you detach this ethics, morality, which I take it you think can be used interchangeably now because that's common usage, do you detach it from religion?
It's not necessarily detached from religion. All I want to argue is that it can exist independently of religion. I mean, certainly you can have religious ethics or ethics that is based on a religion, but what's more important, because some people have denied it, is that you can have ethics without religion. You can have a secular ethics. And indeed, that's what I'm putting forward in books like Practical Ethics. And I think that if we are trying to have a discussion in a pluralist society, then clearly we have to try and do that to some extent. Because if someone says, well, thou shalt not kill because it says so in the scriptures, then for someone for whom those scriptures are not authoritative, obviously that's not a reason for not killing. So if there's going to be reasons for not killing, you have to put forward reasons that are independently of the fact that it says so in some text that a particular religion holds sacred.
As a professional philosopher, are you looking to create a definition of ethics that has almost an absolute use and cannot be relatively dismissed because someone says, well, it's not my belief or something?
Well, I am, to the extent that I'm looking for an ethics that has some sort of basis in reason. Not necessarily that it can finally be grounded on reason to the point that you can claim that anyone who disagrees with your views is irrational. That would be going too far. But at least that you can show that there is scope for argument in ethics, that certain positions are coherent and consistent and that others are not consistent or not coherent. So that it's not just a matter of, well, this is what I believe and it's different from what you believe. You have to go beyond that. You have to try and say a little bit more about why you believe it and how it coheres with other beliefs that you might hold.
How did you find your way to this particular branch of philosophy as opposed to any other field of inquiry, metaphysics, whatever?
Well, I found other fields of philosophy intellectually interesting, intellectually challenging, but in the end I felt that I didn't really want to spend my life doing them because, you know, you get this strange feeling if someone says to you, what do you do? And you say, I'm a philosopher. And they say, well, what are you working on? And you say, well, you know, I'm writing my dissertation on how we can be sure that we really exist. Well, basically they look at you and while, as I say, it might be challenging, in the end, it's not going to make any difference to your life or their life or what they believe. No one is going to, feel reassured if you prove that we can know that we really exist, or for that matter, you know, feel too troubled if you can't. Whereas when you look at things like ethics or social and political philosophy, they're obviously questions that people do need answers to, that that affect our practice, the way we live. So I was much happier dealing with issues where I could say, look, this is important. This is not just intellectually challenging, but it's important. It matters because it lies behind a lot of the things that we do.
Do you want to approach ethics from a summary view? Because one of the things, reading through Practical Ethics, you very quickly get, once you've defined ethics, to specific cases related to what I think you must think is the critical issue of ethics relating to killing, whether it's animals or when and where in human life it's right to end it.
Can I just comment on that? Certainly, questions about ending life, which I would say a little bit more broadly than killing, right? Because allowing to die, which is not killing, is certainly one of the things that I focus on very much as well. So those questions about decision-making for life and death, I do regard as very important, but I don't regard them as necessarily the most important, because my work on animals, for example, is not really based on the wrongness of killing animals. I mean, my arguments for being a vegetarian are based on the fact that, in practice, the rearing of animals inflicts an immense amount of suffering on them that is not justified by the benefits to us of eating them. And in my, wasn't my first book, but I guess the first book that brought me some public attention, Animal Liberation, I was not really arguing from the wrongness of killing animals. I could have done without that altogether and come to the same conclusions. So I think for me, while killing and letting die are certainly important issues, the infliction of suffering and whether we need to do that is perhaps an even more fundamental issue.
Okay, well, why is it one of these things about conversational ethics as opposed to professional ethical theorizing? Is I don't think anybody would say that it's right to cause unnecessary suffering, but why do you think that contemporary animal husbandry is causing this suffering?
Well, in this country, and it's been in most countries, although it's starting to change a little bit in Europe, but certainly in this country, there are essentially no laws to protect farm animals from anything that agribusiness farmers want to do to animals which will make their production more profitable. Okay, so, I mean, there are perhaps laws that protect farm animals if someone was just going to pick up a stick and beat them with it, although actually they're hard to enforce too. But if farmers say, look, we can produce eggs a tiny bit more cheaply if we take the hens and put them in small wire cages, so small that even if one hen were alone in that cage, she could not stretch her wings. And then instead of putting one hen in that cage, we put four, five, or six hens in that cage. So they're so crowded that they can hardly walk around. They can't satisfy any of their basic instincts, like stretching their wings, like dust bathing, like laying their eggs in a nest, like fluttering up to a perch. None of those things are possible. There's nothing in the law that says to a farmer, well, you know, maybe the suffering you're causing to the hen is not justified by the fact that you can now produce the eggs for 1.5 cents less than you could otherwise, or whatever it might be. And the same would be true for the keeping of pigs and veal calves and so on.
But you would go further. I mean, as a vegetarian, you would argue that the slaughtering of a pig and rendering it into a variety of different kinds of cuts of meat is wrong.
Well, I think it is wrong to do when you don't need to do it, yes, but
I mean, people do it because they need to eat.
Well, no, not in this country they don't. No one needs to eat meat in this country. You can walk into your supermarket and you can get a great variety of nutritious, healthy alternatives to meat where you can nourish yourself on perfectly well. There may be people in some other countries who need to kill animals in order to get a good diet, and I wouldn't tell them not to if that's what they need to do to survive. But where we have a relatively simple choice between walking into the supermarket and handing out our money for something that is supporting and reinforcing a system that exploits animals, that takes no account of their welfare except where it interferes with profitability, and as you say, ends up killing them. Or we can use the same amount of money to support production of other food that comes directly from plants. Then I think it's clear what we should do.
What is it about animals that you think you write in detail about processes, I think, of consciousness? Could you just explain to the listeners what it is about animals' consciousness that you think entitles them to this kind of consideration?
Well, essentially, it is that they are conscious. That is, that they can feel things, that they can feel pain, that they can also feel distress, certainly boredom, frustration, and there's good evidence from scientists who spent many years observing farm animals that pigs confined in sow stalls where they can't move, where they're on bare concrete, where they have no opportunities of rooting around and exploring an environment, that they are bored, stressed, and frustrated, and that even chickens can be bored and frustrated in a barren environment. So it's the capacities of these animals to experience their life from the inside and to suffer that really means that they have interest.
Is animal consciousness the same as human consciousness?
Well, certainly the consciousness of animals like, say, pigs, I would say, is very similar to the consciousness of human infants who are not at a more advanced level of development, abstract reflection, self-awareness, and so on. So there are overlaps here. No non-human animal has got the kind of consciousness that means that they could enter into the discussion that we're having right now. But they certainly have consciousness in the way that, as I say, very young humans or humans with some intellectual disability might have.
Which brings us to the point that has made you most controversial. I mean, you just said that animal consciousness has something in common with, say, what, infant consciousness. What are those similarities, and thinking in terms of infants?
Well, we believe that infants can feel pain, that they are sentient beings, and I think we, justifiably, and we try and minimize their pain and distress and suffering. We don't think that infants are rational, self-aware beings. We don't think that they are capable of, making plans for the future. We don't think that they're moral beings in the sense of being able to respond appropriately to situations that involve moral choices. So in all of those ways, their state of mind is rather like the state of mind of non-human mammals. And in fact, when people talk about, say, the mentality of chimpanzees, they often say that chimpanzees are roughly at the stage of a human between 2 and 3 years old in terms of their ability, say, to even use simple language. With other animals, it may be different. But the point is that there's clearly an overlap between the mental capacities of non-human animals and the mental capacities of very young humans.
But in considering the extreme cases, which is, I mean, essentially what you're writing about are the extreme ethical choices that face us in this historical time, where medicine allows the extraordinary prolongation of life in extreme situations and so on. In what circumstances, then, do you think that the infant, you say severely deformed, should be killed, and why is that justifiable?
Okay, let me put it quite precisely. I don't actually say that infants with severe disabilities should be killed. What I do say is that parents who have just, where a woman has just given birth to an infant with severe disabilities, that parents ought to be able to make the decisions about the life and death of their infant. Now, let's not kid ourselves that no decisions get made now, because, even without the particular views that I put forward, in hospitals, say, right here in Boston, when babies are born with severe disabilities, decisions are made as to whether to treat them aggressively so that everything is done to keep them alive, or to treat them more conservatively so that they are more likely to die from an untreated Obstruction of the intestine, perhaps, or from an infection that they develop for which antibiotics are not given, or something of that sort. So life and death decisions are getting made. Increasingly, parents are involved in those decisions, which is a good thing. When I began writing about this area, quite often paternalistic doctors would just make the decisions on their own. So parents are involved. And really what I'm saying is parents should be able to make these decisions. And if a decision is made that it's better that the baby die and that the baby therefore should not be treated in a way that would prolong its life, then I can't see any point in allowing that death to come slowly over days or even weeks with a lot of distress for all concerned, rather than the parents and the doctors being able to agree to end the life quickly.
In this day and age, it's possible for a woman to be, you know, tested while she's pregnant for a variety of abnormalities developing in the fetus. And it's certainly not uncommon for people to be told that, well, the child will be Down syndrome child or whatever, and opting to have an abortion. There is something both emotive and it seems to me, you know, at a gut level, almost logical to say, but there is a difference between aborting a fetus and then dealing in the same way with a severely deformed infant in the first weeks of life. I get the sense that for you, the test carries on postpartum, and that you don't make this big distinction. But I think that most people would have an incredibly emotive feeling that the being outside the body of the mother is somehow different than the being inside the womb.
I think most people do, and this is the curious thing, that for all the fierce opposition that I've had from anti-abortion and right-to-life groups, there's one very fundamental point on which I actually agree with them, and that is that birth does not mark a absolute moral distinction, does not draw such a sharp line between the fetus in the womb and the neonate immediately after birth. Of course, they want to conclude from that therefore we should transfer our present attitudes to the newborn back to the fetus or embryo and from the moment of conception, because it's all a gradual development from then. And they're right, it is all a gradual development. I want to say that, in fact, it's rather the other way around. We may extend, cautiously and not in every respect, but we may extend some of our attitudes towards the fetus to the newborn, who hasn't yet really begun its life, hasn't really developed the kind of awareness that would say, yes, you know, I want to go on living. And I think that makes a difference. The significance of birth, of course, is that a couple can then give a child to another couple if they want to look after it. So in the case of Down syndrome that you mentioned, I would think that parents who didn't want to bring up a child with Down syndrome might be able to find another couple who would do so. Because Down syndrome people can live lives that are, for them, satisfying and happy lives.
That was just a specific example. Are there any number of other genetic abnormalities that can be found out, you know, before the first trimester?
There are, certainly, yeah.
And that was just an example. 800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255. Jerry is on the line.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm from Burlington, Vermont, if it matters. I've been reading up on Peter Singer's viewpoints, I think fairly extensively. I read one article in The New Yorker and several other pieces. And there are certain things that I rather agree with him on. I don't like the cruel way animals are raised. I have mixed feelings about lab testing on animals, and I do consider them sensate beings. I run a restaurant. It's not a vegetarian restaurant, and I don't intend it to be vegetarian. I don't agree that we get all our nutrition properly from we can get it all from soy or any other factor, although we get a lot. I've looked into this in detail, in great detail, as it is my field. Something that really bothered me in reading about him was that he's fairly quick on the trigger when it comes to other people, but when his mother was suffering from, if I recall, Alzheimer's, he had no problem in keeping her alive beyond what he said was proper for the rest of us.
No, that's quite wrong. I've never said that people in their mother's condition should not be kept alive. That's a myth which you've picked up from some journalist that put their own twist on the story.
Is that so? That she was kept alive beyond when she, in many cases, would be said she could go and not hurt the rest of us in any way.
But I've never said that people who are not suffering should not be kept alive if they're able to, have some simple pleasures, as my mother is, through eating. I've never said that people have to be killed or anything like that. I mean, that's a complete distortion of my views.
We've come to a point, though, we started talking about the beginning of life, where, mm-hmm. and so on, but extending life, where do you begin to make lines, draw lines about benefits?
Well, you were talking about someone who is old and near the end of life. I think that's their choice, really. I think that certainly if they're competent, they should be able to make the decision as to how long they want to go on living. And that's why I strongly support laws like the law that allows physician-assisted suicide in Oregon, because that allows at least some of those patients to make that decision. I would go further and support a law that allows voluntary euthanasia, as is the practice in the Netherlands and briefly was in Australia's Northern Territory, because physician-assisted suicide can only help those people who can actually swallow something and digest it. And, of course, some patients are terminally ill precisely because they have a cancer of the stomach or somewhere like that and can't really keep stuff down. So that's the first thing. You know, it's really an individual's choice. In terms of someone who might be aware that they have dementia developing dementia, I think they ought to be able to make a living will, and if they want to specify that they don't want to live beyond a certain point, they should have that right. But if they don't want to, if they want to say, well, look, as long as I'm not suffering, I want to go on living, that's fine too.
Where does the concept of soul enter into your analysis?
I don't have such a concept. If by soul you mean something that survives the physical death of the being, the body, I don't see any reason to believe that there is such a thing.
Why do you reject that?
Well, for the same reason as I don't believe that there's fairies in the bottom of my garden, really. I want evidence before I believe in the existence of things. And I haven't seen any evidence of survival beyond death.
Not likely to.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, lots of stories. People claim to be able to communicate with spirits of their parents or whatever through seances, but you know, it doesn't hold up. You can't test it. You can't ever find really clear cases that prove something that you couldn't have known that can later be independently discovered. So, and if that evidence does turn up, well, obviously I'll have to reconsider my views.
So you would... I mean, there are people who would say then that, you know, clear difference between humans and animals is we have a soul. I mean, that is a theological point held by certainly.
But I would say, how do you know? You know, what's your evidence for that? You can't just say, I believe that. I mean, people could get away with all sorts of things then. You know, you could defend racism by saying, well, only Europeans have souls. Africans don't have souls. I mean, that's just nonsense.
How do you select your areas for analysis? The world is the case. There's all manner of daily interactions between people that require ethical choices. You obviously can't write about all of it. Let's take your jacket off. The studio is very warm. But why do you select one area for analysis as opposed to another?
Well, I guess... I select the areas that I think have interesting philosophical content and that matter. Some of the issues that face us are really just matters of trying to get the facts right.
For example?
Well, let me take one that's not entirely matters of fact, but at least partly. The decision of NATO to intervene in Kosovo. To a large extent, I think that depends on the question of were the civilian inhabitants of Kosovo being killed in very large numbers by Serbs? Was there any way to stop that short of the bombing campaign or some other military intervention? Was the military intervention likely to succeed in creating a better situation? Those are questions which... need very detailed knowledge and are probably difficult for anyone to answer, but really need very detailed knowledge of exactly what the situation there is. That's not something that a philosopher is particularly likely to have. So, you know, a philosopher could, I guess, discuss some of the questions of the rights and wrongs of intervention, of national sovereignty, some of those issues, but perhaps can't take the question very much further. Some of the issues about that we've been talking about the sanctity of life, the facts are fairly easy to establish. Now, again, there are certainly relevant facts about, you know, what life is like with certain disabilities, but the facts that these decisions are being made, that, let's say, doctors withdraw treatment or withhold treatment from disabled infants and allow them to die, that's easy to establish. And then there's a big moral issue about whether that conduct, allowing to die, is significantly different from active killing. And that's something that you can reason about philosophically, but that you don't really require a whole lot more facts in order to come to a view about it.
We're coming up to the break. When we come out of the break, I want to ask you again about whether you would, as your life's work, want to try and set up a codification of how to make these decisions. We're talking with Peter Singer, bioethicist, professor of philosophy at Princeton University in this hour. We'll be back after a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI, Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Museum of Fine Arts, celebrating the work of a master printmaker and painter, Michael Mazur. A print retrospective runs now through May 14th. Details on the web at mfa.org. Landry and Arcari Oriental Rugs and Carpeting, opening a new wall-to-wall carpeting showroom, The Carpet Source, next door, Pleasant Street, Salem. It's 37 degrees in Boston. The forecast tonight becoming mostly cloudy. Scattered flurries mainly after midnight with a low around 25 to 30. Tomorrow cloudy, becoming brisk with rain developing in the afternoon, possibly mixing with or starting out as sleet or snow at the onset. Highs 40 to 45. Saturday night rain may be heavy at times. Sunday rain ending by noon. Mostly cloudy and brisk in the afternoon with some scattered showers. WBUR supporters include David's Moving and Storage Incorporated, relocating individuals and corporations on a local and national level, including Canada. 800-239-3388 or on the web at davidsmoving.com. And by Bicon Dental Implants, providing alternatives for patients considering root canal treatments. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Faulkner Hospital. Bicon.com. In sports, the Celtics still leading the Chicago Bulls 66-45, while the Bruins are leading the Carolina Hurricanes 2-1.
I'm Gina Cervetti. When you give more to WBUR, you get more out of life. Topics you didn't even know you cared about until you heard them on The Connection. Commentators who brilliantly distill the essence of life. Your pledges pay for more than half the cost of the news. Look for a letter from WBUR asking you to pledge for more news and less on air fundraising. Then, be as generous as you can. Learn more at 1-800-909-9287. And thanks.
I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking with Peter Singer, bioethicist, professor of philosophy at Princeton University. In this hour, we've been talking about animal rights. We've been talking about when and where, we haven't used the word, but I think the word you use is sentience, enters into the human equation and thus seems to separate out certain decisions about life, that it's a dividing line. Sentience, in Peter Singer's view, is not something that we are born with. We don't see the light of day with it. It's something that we acquire.
Well, I think actually we're born sentient, but we're not born self-aware. I think that's what we acquire during the first year of life. I think I think newborns are capable of feeling pain, and that's really enough to make them sentient. But certainly they're not born with a sense that here I am, I was around yesterday, and I hope to be around tomorrow. That's something that develops.
And this puts them into a different category for the hard ethical choices that we face these days in terms of illness and our ability to save lives.
I think so. And, you know, the reason I come up with this, people might say, well, that's a fairly arbitrary characteristic. But I think you have to ask, why is it so much more serious normally to kill a human being than it is to kill an animal? And despite my views, you know, that killing an animal is more serious than most people think it is, I have to agree that, you know, when I read in the paper that someone went into a high school or a church and just randomly killed 10 or 20 people, I think that's a terrible tragedy. And it's a greater tragedy than the killing of, you know, thousands or millions of chickens. I would accept that. So it has to be something about humans that separates them from those chickens. And it can't just be that they're members of our species. That doesn't seem to be enough. So I think it has to be something to do with the kind of lives that humans can live and do live that perhaps chickens are not capable of living. That makes it worse.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. The Edge is on the line.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's a very stimulating discussion.
Sure, thank you.
I have a question, well, sort of a comment and a question to take on the original definition of ethic that you mentioned, that it's sort of some moral code which tells us how we could live our lives. And you also kind of touched upon the religious ethics part of it. My opinion is that religion started off by being just a set of rules, set of ethics to help promote some sort of social order. And one of the problems is that some of these rules and some of these social orders were made up by people like you many, many hundreds of thousands of years ago, which may or may not be relevant today. So my question to you is, when you set up these rules, or when you say that this is how it should be done, by thinking about them, by looking for evidence about them, would you put in a clause over there which would say that, well, 25 years later or 50 years later, I would like to review the assumptions of this. Maybe the assumptions are no longer valid. To kind of throw in one example, I think a lot of the rules of religion are based on promoting survival of humans. So, for example, certain food habits are promoted based on that. Yeah. People say, eat meat because of that, or whatever.
Well, look, in a way, that's already built into my ethical view that when circumstances change, the ethical conclusions change, because I'm not really trying to put forward a set of absolute rules for all time in the way that religion generally has. You know, you have the idea of the Ten Commandments. They're actually engraved in stone, both literally and, of course, metaphorically, so that they don't change. Well, my view is that you ought to be concerned with the consequences of what you're doing, so that if now the consequences of eating meat, for example, are quite different from what they were when our ancestors were tribal shepherds in the Middle East, in the arid lands, where you could not survive without eating meat, then, of course, the ethics of killing for food were quite different from what they are now. So that that changes, you know, if people come to my point of view, that change is just going to happen as the circumstances change.
So moral relativism, all manner of relativisms you try to avoid in distilling your thought, but historical relativism is something you see as inevitable in ethical discussions.
Well, can I draw a distinction? I don't consider this relativism. I consider this consequentialism. It would be relativist if I were to say that there are no universal principles that survive from one historical era to another. But I don't say that. I mean, in a way, what I'm saying is that if you are in a situation where you cannot survive without inflicting some suffering on another sentient being, you may do so. If you are no longer in that situation and you can survive very well without it, then you may not do so. So that's what's changed over the course of history.
Just the word consequential, just...
Okay, a consequentialist ethic is one that says the question of whether something is right or wrong depends on the consequences of the action that you're considering. So Whereas that would contrast with what our caller was talking about, perhaps an ethic based on rules, where you might simply say, look, the question just is, does this violate the rule? So the rule is, thou shalt not kill, however we understand that. Let's say we interpret that as meaning, thou shalt not kill an innocent human being. Here you've killed an innocent human being, therefore what you've done is wrong. End of story, right? Whereas on my view, we want to say, yes, true, you've violated a generally accepted rule. That's a good reason to think carefully about what you're doing, to reflect on it. But if this innocent human being was one who, let's say, could not possibly have a life that was going to be free of distress or suffering and was going to die within a few months anyway, then that's a different case. And even though it violates some generally accepted rule, it may nevertheless be the right thing to do because it has good consequences and doesn't have the usual bad consequences of killing.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Rob is on a car phone.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing? Great to hear this discussion this morning. I did have a question, and I think you just started touching on it, which would be, what is your viewpoint on cultural relativism and how that might come into play into this philosophy?
Yeah, well, it does follow from what we were talking about, and you know, I'm not a cultural relativist in a deep sense. That is, I don't think that the fact that it's customary, let's say, to perform female genital mutilation in some areas of North Africa means that it's all right for those societies to do it. But I do accept that you have to be culturally sensitive and that differences in different cultures mean that different things work for those cultures, and that if you think that they need to be changed, then you certainly need to go about it in a way that is not going to have other consequences damaging for the culture that it might have if you just, you know, thought that it was happening in this culture where it wouldn't have those kinds of consequences.
Well, it must be based on reason then in a lot of ways.
That's right, exactly. And the idea is that reason is something which at some points is universal. That is, that there are some principles that, you know, perhaps very, very general principles, very limited in what they can do, but that do underlie a sound morality in any culture.
What are some of your basic principles then?
Well, I guess the idea of minimizing suffering or minimizing pain and distress would be a basic principle, and that would be something that I would think would be good in any culture. But exactly what would minimize distress would vary according to the cultures that existed and the attitudes that people had.
But we were just talking about the case of the practice of clitoridectomy in North Africa. You say that there you would apply an absolute. In a sense, you wouldn't be culturally relative.
In that I think that's a bad practice. But
I mean,
not in
how do you arrive at the decision that it's a bad practice?
Well, I think that it, and perhaps we should be more specific here, there are some very minor operations performed in some cultures which are probably no more severe than circumcision in Western cultures for males. And maybe there you would, although some people, you know, would even oppose that here in the West, but maybe you would think that that's okay. But there are certainly some kinds of clitoridectomy which prevent women from obtaining enjoyment from sexual intercourse. And that seems to me to be a major loss. And we ought to work towards a society in which that doesn't have to happen. Now, it can't perhaps be done very easily if the culture is such that women who do not have this operation performed are not going to be able to find husbands, are going to be ostracized or something like that. Then obviously you need to be sensitive to that, and you need to try and change the attitudes rather than just going in and trying to prohibit the performance of the operation.
We're talking with Peter Singer in this hour, Connection listeners. We're talking about difficult ethical choices in a world of rapidly advancing scientific knowledge that allows us to keep people alive when even 50 years ago they would have died. Is it right to allow them to die when you have control of that? We're also talking to Peter Singer, or we will be, about the increasing knowledge that we have of what we are, not just in terms of consciousness, but what our structures are in our genetic makeup. 800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255. Fred is on the line.
Hello. I wanted to ask a question. First of all, I wanted to thank you for giving me the strength to be a vegetarian. I took a morals course when I was 17 and read an article by you. And
great. That's
a vegetarian
good to hear. Thank
two
you.
Days later.
Terrific.
So my question is about conflict displacement. That's the term I put to it. But how this society and modern societies keep putting themselves further and further away from the conflict, i.e. the killing or the harming, and yet the consequences are the same. So I'll give you an example. I have a perverse sort of appreciation for hunters who go out and kill for food, not for sport,
mm-hmm.
Versus shoppers
yes.
who go and purchase meat. The conflict happened, but they can feel like it didn't.
Yes.
And that extends to all sorts of things, whether it's we want cheap goods, but we would never work for the wages that produce the cheap goods.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just wanted some of your thoughts on that.
Well, I kind of share your views about hunting in a way. I mean, I know a lot of people in the animal movement are very hard on hunters, and I don't actually support it, but nevertheless, you have to agree that they have faced what they're doing to an animal, and the people who go and buy a chicken have probably never really thought about what that chicken's life was like in a huge shed with, 10,000 other chickens, all the stresses it went through, the brutal process of throwing them out of the shed into crates, trucking them to the slaughterhouse, hanging them upside down, still fully conscious on a conveyor belt until they get stunned, hopefully, but not all of them do, and then get their throats cut and go into the scalding tank. And people don't think about that, and if they did, probably they would think differently about what they're buying. Whereas the hunters face it, and very often the animals they kill actually have better lives and cleaner deaths than the animals that you are buying bits of in a supermarket. So I agree with you. I have a little bit more respect for that than I do for people who don't actually think about the impact of what they're doing at all.
I was speaking a minute ago about our increased knowledge of our genetic makeup. What new areas of inquiry does this open up for you as an ethicist?
Well, I've been interested in the questions about the way in which we can develop a society that is a kinder, more compassionate, more caring society. And yet I have to face the fact that, in my view, essentially Darwin was right about our origins. That is, we have evolved, in a sense, in competition with other species and also with other members of our own species. And one view of that, of course, was that it's a kind of ruthless struggle for survival in which only the ruthless egoist is going to leave descendants, and therefore we all have this rather egoistic nature that we have inherited from that. Now, I've explored in a recent book that's just about to appear here called A Darwinian Left about the way in which those who are sympathetic to this more caring, compassionate society, those broadly on the left, can accept an evolutionary view and work with that. And I think it's now possible to do it because evolutionary theory has become more complex, more sophisticated. And we know, for example, that cooperation plays an important role in evolution, and that survival is not just a matter of being more ruthless or brutal, but also perhaps of being a better cooperator, and therefore of being accepted into beneficial cooperative arrangements. So what I'm arguing in A Darwinian Left is that we can try and build on this. We can try and build on the natural tendency that humans have to cooperate under certain conditions and try and create the conditions for a more cooperative society rather than one which emphasizes the egoistic individualist streak in our nature.
How do you imagine that happening?
Well, I think that there's various kinds of changes that can take place. We can try and put up social structures that bring people into more long-term relationships and make those relationships ones that foster cooperation. I think part of the problem is that, for most of our evolutionary history, we lived in small societies where we got to know the other members of our society, and we interacted with them frequently over long periods. So those are the conditions in which cooperative relationships flourish. If we have a vast anonymous society, where we, you know, encounter someone, have some dealings with them, and never see them again, then the payoffs for cooperation really aren't there. So we have to try and create structures in which people are able to be assured that this will be a long-term relationship.
800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255. Matt is on the line.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question for Professor Singer and a comment, I guess, about his views on famine and suffering and our duties to people who are suffering from that. It seems interesting to me that since Professor Singer has become a public figure, not just a philosophical figure, that these views have been put sort of in the background, and that we've focused a lot on his bioethical views about how we ought to treat infants and things like that. But these other views about our duties to people who are suffering seem so much more important. To some extent, it seems ironic, for example, to see someone like Steve Forbes, who was a really vocal critic of Professor Singer, about his appointment to Princeton, arguing, you know, that he was sort of like a Hitler figure with some of his bioethical views. Yet, someone like Steve Forbes is guilty of these egregious moral sins.
You're talking about Steve Forbes is an alumni.
Right, alumnus of Princeton.
Princeton, and he says, no more of all of my millions to the university so long as this man is there.
Right, Professor Singer's views about the sort of what amount of our resources we owe to people who are suffering from famine or can't meet their basic needs, that according to those views, Forbes thinks that, you know, Singer is espousing these very immoral views, yet there's a sense in which Steve Forbes is a paradigm example.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, he's just now gone and spent, what was it, $60 million on his, you know, pretty hopeless presidential bid, which
right.
could have really seen was pretty hopeless from the start. And if he's concerned about saving innocent life, you know, you have to think what $60 million could do in countries where people live on a dollar a day.
Is there an ethical or moral equivalence between Steve Forbes' decision to spend $60 million in a fruitless quest for the presidency? He's attacking you for your views on when it is ethically correct to kill an infant. Is there any moral equivalence in this discussion? Because you actually say, you know, people who earn over, what is it these days, given inflation, $30,000 a year, that income earned over that, people should really just give to the poor.
Well, that's the kind of ideal figure. I don't really expect people to do that. But certainly the point is that once you've provided for your basic needs, you should be aware that what you spend on luxuries could contribute to saving lives in some of the poorest countries of the world. That's true. And certainly, I do think that these things are connected because... And I think Matt is quite right that it's a pity that there has been less attention to this aspect of my views, probably just because it's less controversial and you don't get, you know, protesters attacking me about it. But one of my views is that the distinction between allowing someone to die when you could save their life or prolong their life and actively ending their life is not such a sharp distinction as people make out. And that's why I said when I was talking about infants, that in hospitals right here in this city, doctors are making decisions to treat infants conservatively, knowing that that means that the infants will die, and no one gets terribly alarmed about that. They only get alarmed if I suggest that then it would be more compassionate to end the infants' lives quickly. Now, the same sort of thing happens, of course, in our failure to do very much for people in the poorest countries. We are allowing people to die, and I think our record is disgraceful. Not only someone like Steve Forbes, who could have easily put that $60 million to do it, but as a nation, the United States is absolutely at the bottom of all the economically developed countries in the percentage of its gross national product that it gives to foreign aid for the poorest countries. It gives less than 0.1% of its gross national product, whereas the United Nations goal is 0.7%. So it's less than a seventh. And it's, for example, only a tenth of what some of the European nations give.
Matt brought up the point. You are now a public intellectual. When you write, when you speak, it does have an impact far beyond the academic world of philosophy. Presumably, that's your intention.
Sure, I have views about things that we could do better than we're doing, and I like to reach a wide audience, yes.
Do you ever consider that some of what you write actually may be willfully misinterpreted because it touches on a highly emotive issue? And what do you say to people who do willfully misinterpret your work?
I'm sure that there are people willfully misinterpreting my work. I have contempt for that, where they know what they're doing. And I think it's a serious problem for the nature of democracy in a free society, that indeed there's the media, it seems to me, often have a vested interest in doing that because it makes for better headlines and better stories.
Is it an ethical dilemma for you to consider what it is you're writing and what you're putting forth?
Yes, I certainly have to consider how what I'm writing is going to be taken. It may be that these views that have been the particular touchstone, I guess, about the treatment of disabled infants, are views that I actually have held for a long time. I put them forward, I think, for the first time in the first edition of Practical Ethics, which came out in 1979. They didn't cause any controversy anywhere in the world, really, outside academic discussions, until about 1989, 10 years later, when I first had encountered protests on a visit to Germany. If I'd foreseen, exactly where it would go, maybe I would have put all that differently, because for me, it's not the most important issue.
Thank you, Peter Singer, for coming in today. Peter Singer is in Boston to speak at the Program on Medical Ethics at Harvard Medical School. Thank you very much for coming in. Much to think about. I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Cassettes of The Connection are available for $15, including shipping and handling. To order, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.